Okay. Well, as you, as you may well have learned through the news, it's about just 10 days or so ago that the poet Lawrence Ferlinghetti died. And I have a fair amount of his stuff. And he was, you know, somebody who really had an influence on my, well, just how I saw the world, starting from right after I got home from Vietnam, and also helped lead me to Buddha Dharma. And so I went back and reread some of his stuff for, I don't know, fifth or sixth time, and came to realize and appreciate how much of an influence he and some of his colleagues really did have on bringing me to the Dharma. And so I thought that I would like to devote some of this evening just to focusing on his work and that of some others, especially with regard to helping bring the Dharma in one form into sort of mainstream American society. And then, of course, also the relating a little bit how some of this early work really brings forth some of the Dharma that we've come to know. So the way that I first came to know his work was right after I came home from Vietnam. 4 days after I came home from Vietnam, I was registering for classes at the University of Arizona in the fall of 1966. And the University of Arizona at Tucson was a huge campus, had about 20,000 students. And most of the freshman lectures were 500, 600, 700 people held in, you know, giant auditoriums and whatnot. And I was in really, really rocky shape mentally. You know, I'd just come home, just a few weeks out of this bloody war in Southeast Asia, and here I was with these masses of people, and just like the military, I was known more by my identification number than my name. I didn't have any meaningful relationships with anybody, and I was in a pretty disturbed state of mind, really, I think, depressed and shaken up and whatnot. So I went to hear this reading, and I couldn't make sense out of most of it, but some of the themes that started to come up, that started to come forth in this writing, had to do with the liberation of mind and with being freed from the ruts in which we'd been trained to think and the ruts in which we'd been trained to see the world. He has one early collection of poems that he put together called A Coney Island of the Mind. And I found myself kind of resonating with that because in part it's a reminiscence about the childhood that he wished he'd had. I could really sort of resonate with that. You know, Jack Kornfield, a Dharma teacher in our tradition, he said, you know, coming to the Dharma means abandoning all hope that you may have had of having a better past. You know, it's like, instead, it's about coming to terms with and developing a kind relationship with your karma, you know, not wishing that it had been different than it was, no matter how hard some of it may have been. So there was really that aspect about his writing that a bunch of lights went on, and I said, this is somebody that kind of gets it, kind of knows what's going on with me. I later came to find that he was a naval officer in World War II, and he was the skipper of a destroyer escort, and his ship participated in the D-Day landing in 1944, which really helped explain in some ways how he became such a powerful anti-war advocate afterwards. So anyway, on winter break, I decided I've really got to, you know, expose myself to more of this. So I drove up to the Bay Area from Tucson. I stayed with a family friend and spent time hanging out in North Beach. This is, you know, late 1960s. And I have stumbled into this world, the like of which I had never before experienced. It was kind of a different place then. It was almost like a little Italian town inside of a city. There were cappuccino bars and coffee shops and bakeries with fresh sourdough and Italian pastries every morning, and Italian delis and imported wine shops and restaurants and art galleries and folk and jazz clubs. And at the center of it all was City Lights Bookstore. And I'd never been anywhere like City Lights either. And I'm still not sure if there really sort of is one. Lawrence Ferlinghetti established it in 1953 with a friend. And what it was he was, you know, he instead of describing himself as the first of the Beats, he described himself as the last of the Bohemians, you know. And he had this notion that poetry and literature ought to be for the masses, and there ought to be an outlet for literature that wasn't getting published anywhere else. And so in addition to running his bookstore, he also started a little publishing company where he began publishing a lot of the work of the Beat poets of the early 1950s, you know, like Allen Ginsberg and Gary Snyder, and published stuff by Jack Kerouac and others. And it was all done up in these little books printed on really cheap paper that didn't cost very much to buy, that could fit in your in a pocket of a jacket, and it was called Pocket Poets. That was that series, and a lot of them, like Allen Ginsberg and Gary Snyder, had really started to really get into the Dharma in a pretty serious way, and so their experiences in the Dharma really began to be woven into their work and to influence it. And so when I was there, I said, you know, it's not a matter of if I come back here, but when, you know. So I went back to Tucson, the U of A, and realized I had to find a more a less toxic environment to go to school in. So I found this little private college in Northern Arizona that had contracted out its athletic program to the Colorado Outward Bound School. And so instead of team sports, which I detested anyway, learned how to climb rocks and kayak down whitewater you know, rivers, and go out and play in the wilderness, right, and take others out, you know. And I actually taught wilderness medicine there for a while. So when I graduated from college there in 1970, went back to the Bay Area, and I met this wonderful woman that I fell in love with, and we got married on Pescadero Beach, south of San Francisco. And this June, we celebrate our 50th wedding anniversary. and I love the North Beach scene, but it was just really intense and urban as well. And so I started hanging out more over in Berkeley, and that was really more my speed. It was, which is to say, it was slower paced. And there was kind of a little mini version of North Beach on this strip of Telegraph Avenue where it dead ends into the Berkeley campus at the south gate, the main gate, and the stretch for about 3/4 of a mile or so. A lot of the same thing, terrific little coffee shops and bakeries and a lot of head shops and bookstores up the wazoo. So it really had some of that same feeling, but it was also much slower paced and more kind of grounded in nature. And so just really the place for me. It turned out the only marketable skill I had from college was running outdoor trips. And so I got this job working for the extension division at UC Berkeley, taking troubled youth from Berkeley High School out into the wilderness on kind of many outward bound trips. And it's not like they were all thugs. Most of them were stoners. You know? A few of them were into psychedelics. And so I took them up into the Ventana Wilderness down at Big Sur, the Santa Lucia Mountains. And we just, you know, had a wonderful time up there. And it was a great way to kind of make a living. Meanwhile, back in Berkeley, where Abby and I were living, there were all these, there was this real surfeit of Dharma riches starting to flow into town. Our first meditation retreat was with a Tibetan teacher named Tarthang Tulku, who had his Western seat in this nice big old ex-fraternity house near where we lived. Trungpa Rinpoche would come to town, and he would hold these big get-togethers in the Pali Ballroom on the Berkeley campus. So we got a big taste of Vajrayana Dharma from him as well. We met friends, you know, who were also in the kind of the Dharma scene there that became friends for the rest of our lives. And they had friends who had just come back from spending time as monks and nuns or doing long-term intensive retreats in Asia in the Theravada tradition. And so we did our very first insight meditation retreat in 1975 with Joseph Goldstein and Jack Hornfield and Sharon Salzberg, all teaching together. And it was before there was an Insight Meditation Society or Spirit Rock. And it was this transformative experience that, you know, that basically changed our lives as well as our relationship. And we have been on that path ever since. So one interesting thing really caught my attention, very much unlike the retreats today that you'll find, let's see, which are really grounded in just sort of the basics straight out of the discourses, you know, as translated by people like Bhikkhu Bodhi and Bhante Anolio. Back then, even though Joseph and Sharon and Jack were all teaching pretty straight up Dharma, the means by which they sought to, you know, they talk about some of the ideas, but insofar as seeking to convey what it really felt like to experience the expanded mind or the opening of the heart, cessation of the construction of self, they actually relied a lot on poetry. And so there was some poet, there was some, you know, Zen poetry and old texts like that, things in Basho and whatnot. But a lot of it was, they drew from Rumi and Kabir and Khalil Gibran, Omar Khayyam, William Blake, the Beats. Drew, especially Joseph, he was very fond of the Taoist texts, and so he brought in Lao Tzu, the Shuang Tzu, poetry of Li Po. And what this was really helpful for doing, because poetry kind of sneaks in, you know, the stage door, insofar as consciousness is concerned. What it did was we're able to convey through listening to some of this work the experience of these things in a way that just hearing about them in prose didn't really quite get it, you know. And it was these experiences, this experiential learning through the heart mind instead of only cognitive discourse, that really helped me come to better understand, you know, what the Dharma was all about. And I could, as I begin to have more and more of these experiences myself. So 25 years after my first encounters with the Dharma, I started training to be a Dharma teacher. But by then there was a lot of focus on the canonical texts, and so we could convey teachings as clearly and as authentically as possible through our respective teaching lineages in Thailand and Burma. And after I finished my training and started teaching a little over 20 years ago, my cohort and I would have these reunion in-service training retreats with people like Bhikkhu Bodhi, one of the foremost English translators of the Pali Canon. And we had this talk about, you know, is it okay to, you know, kind of come in from the side here with things like poetry, insofar as trying to convey some essential teachings of the Dharma. And he said, yeah, I said, it's been going on for 2,500 years. He said, what's really important, though, is if you can try to be clear when you're teaching, when it is you're drawing something from an authentic text, and when it is that you're bringing in something to sort of help make a point or to help convey a sense. And he said, as long as you do that, you know, you'll be fine. He pointed out that there's a website out there that somewhere that's titled Things the Buddha Never Said. So it's, you know, just kind of a way to stay grounded, because you get too carried away and then it all kind of starts to degenerate into kind of new age mishmash. And so, you know, and Bhikkhu Bodhi talked about the time, he said, you know, he said he distinguishes the two as canonical Buddhism and adaptive Buddhism. And he said, you know, if you're going to the extent that you really do engage in adaptive Buddhism, just make sure that you're still kind of conveying, you know, what the Dharma is all about. One of the poems I want to share with you tonight of Ferlinghetti's, when I would go back after having, you know, been immersed in the Dharma for a while, first 10 years or so, I would go back and read some of these poems again, and they would really have quite a different and deeper meaning than they did the first time when I, you know, couldn't really quite make out what they were saying, including some of the Ferlinghetti's work, because I could see it was relating very directly to teachings from our tradition on things like anatta, like anicca, ceaseless change and arising and passing, you know, and how to experience that as it occurs without grief or regret, but simply accepting things as they are. And so one of the poems I want to share with you this evening that touches on that, it's about anicca actually, is one that he wrote in the late 50s, I think, early 60s maybe. And it was in a collection called Lost Landscapes. And the title of the poem is The Old Italian's Dying. And he came to North Beach in the early 1950s. You might wonder why it's called North Beach, because it's close to a mile from the nearest water. In the 1800s, especially right after the gold rush, the shoreline on the eastern shore of the San Francisco Peninsula actually did come way into to where North Beach is today. And that part of town was really, the cops didn't even go there. It was just, you know, it was right, it was the wharves. It was where the cargo ships would come in and bringing supplies to haul out to the, you know, to the mines, to the 49ers up in the foothills of the Sierras. And what would happen is that these cargo ships would come in and they would offload their cargo, and all the sailors would abandon ship and head for the gold fields. And so over time, there were more and more of these abandoned three-master ships there in this area along the beach. And they tried to use them as hotels for a while. People would squat there. They'd catch fire. It's just a horrible mess. And so after a while, what they started doing was setting fire to the ones that hadn't burned already, crunch them up, throw rocks and dirt on them, and create landfill. And so everything from the North Beach neighborhood down to the water now is on landfill. It's built on old ships and rocks. It's really unstable. So whenever there's an earthquake, it shakes like crazy and all the buildings fall down. That's exactly what happened in 1906. The whole place was destroyed by fire, and they had to start building over. But around that time, there was an influx of immigrants, especially from northern Italy, that moved into that part of town because no one else wanted to live there. It was kind of dangerous, you know, right near the Barbary Coast. Land was cheap, and they built themselves places to live. Went to work mostly as fishermen down on the Fisherman's Wharf, and established this little colony, this little North Italian colony there in North Beach. For the most part, back up until like around the 50s, they really tended to keep to themselves. But as North Beach evolved and changed, then sort of that community until it began to fade away. So Lawrence Ferlinghetti moved to North Beach in 1951. And he was writing poetry. He's also a pretty successful painter. Started City Lights Bookstore in 1953. And then even when I was there in 67, it was just this fascinating refuge for rare and endangered species of literature, things you'd never find anywhere else. And books that he, because no one else would publish them, he was starting to publish these books of bee poetry. 1953, 54, I guess it was, he published a book of poem, or he published a book-length poem by his friend Allen Ginsberg called Howl. Back then, to a greater extent than today, but it's still to some extent the case, the sort of the ethnic enclaves and which ethnicities had control of what aspects of the city and what locations in the city. Law enforcement and fire services were pretty much dominated by the Irish. And the old money in downtown San Francisco after World War II that were really keen on keeping San Francisco a proper community and not letting it, you know, trying to get away from its 19th century images of, you know, kind of a Wild West town on the coast. And so the big money, the downtown money, the bank owners and whatnot, they really were invested in seeing San Francisco be a certain way, cleaning up this crazy, you know, promiscuous city. And so there was a police captain in whose precinct was the North Beach, Captain Hanrahan. And he went on this kind of mission with his officers to clean up North Beach. And they decided that first off, you know, they were going to target the dirty bookstores. And so they considered City Lights to be a dirty bookstore because they were selling these books that had been banned elsewhere in the United States, and they're being imported from Europe, and they're publishing their own. There's some pretty vivid descriptions of sex acts and Howl, among other things, and Ginsberg's poem. So Hanrahan had his men go in there and arrest Lawrence Ferlinghetti and his co-owner for obscenity, and they brought him to trial in municipal court in San Francisco, and the trial was really fascinating. It was this cheap little paperback bookstore, right, that was trying to sell stuff that you couldn't buy anywhere else. Hanrahan was on this mission, and he told the press, I think he probably had an interest in going into politics. He said, this is just the start. He said, there are these completely unacceptable books being sold all around that neighborhood. You know, and he mentioned books like Tropic of Cancer and Lady Chatterley's Lover and stuff like that. And he said, this is just the beginning. We're going to clean this place up. And that really freaked everybody out. So they all ran off to court. The ACLU jumped right in and agreed to represent Ferlinghetti for free. So they had this trial that drew national attention with all these arguments about, you know, here we had basically the cops in San Francisco deciding what everyone else was going to read. And the DA was backing them up. You know, they want to clean up the town. And so anyway, they had this trial that gained more and more national attention. Life magazine did a pictorial story about it, got huge amounts of publicity. And of course, Ferlinghetti was acquitted. Meantime, he had just gotten hundreds of thousands of dollars of free publicity. And so people were flocking from all over the country to City Lights bookstore, right? Buying everything in sight. He was publishing more and more dirty books and getting, you know, everything was getting more and more effervescent. And North Beach was discovered as this place, you know, this kind of nuclear reactor for new culture, counterculture coming forth in San Francisco. And so as a result, it started to become more and more popular. By the time I went there in the late 60s, it was already beginning to change. The old Italians who had come there in the late 19th century to found Little Italy, you know, now the rents were going up and it was becoming so popular, it was becoming kind of a chichi place to live and hang out, that a lot of them couldn't afford to live there anymore, and they kind of dissipated and went their separate ways. So there was kind of a diaspora, and the Italian families were getting established elsewhere. Several of them were becoming quite good, you know, getting wealthy, becoming wealthy in local businesses. There was an entrepreneur down in Fisherman's Wharf that got some changes in zoning, so you could actually have restaurants on the Fisherman's Wharf, so they could offload the fish right out of the boat into the back of the restaurant, right? And his name was Joe Alioto, and he was a real kind of entrepreneurial type, wound up getting himself elected mayor of San Francisco and made it a very friendly, you know, place to do business. That's when all the high-rises started coming in. He's followed by another Italian mayor named George Moscone. He was assassinated along with the first gay supervisor in the San Francisco board, Harvey Milk, by another supervisor, Dan White, who was a former cop in San Francisco and couldn't afford to keep his job as supervisor. So he resigned and then changed his mind and wanted back. And Moscone said, you know, I don't think so. You're out, you're out. And so White snuck in a side door with a pistol and assassinated them both. But the Italians were really exercising more, Italian Americans exercising more and more of a kind of outsized role in San Francisco politics. And there is this fairly outspoken Italian American woman who was elected to Congress to represent that part of the city. Her name is Nancy Pelosi. So there's this part of town has produced a lot of energy for, you know, the big changes in American culture. But this poem that Ferlinghetti wrote is kind of ironic because he saw that as North Beach was becoming more popular, that it was losing more and more of the character that he had come to love about it. And he wrote this poem in terms of, Washington Square is a nice park right there in North Beach, and Peter and Paul's church is there. And it's where the old timers would come and sit. And so he wrote this poem called The Old Italians Dying. But at the same time, anyone who knew North Beach knew that the poem was much more than about what he was just describing. The poem's really about the death of North Beach as he had known it, you know, and the inevitable changes that were going on. He was a painter as well as a poet, and sometimes his poems have been described as moving paintings, you know. So at any rate, I want to go ahead and read this poem. And then what I want to do then, believe it or not, is stop running my mouth. So all of us who have been touched by, you know, the poetry of Buddha Dharma in the West, maybe can share our own reflections or memories, you know. So here we go. Thank you. For years, the old Italians have been dying all over America. For years, the old Italians in faded felt hats have been sunning themselves and dying. You have seen them on the benches in the park in Washington Square. The old Italians in their black high-button shoes, the old men in their old felt fedoras with stained hat bands have been dying and dying day by day. You have seen them every day in Washington Square, San Francisco. The slow bell tolls in the morning in the Church of Peter and Paul, in the Marzipan Church on the plaza. Toward 10 in the morning, the slow bell tolls in the towers of Peter and Paul, and the old men who are still alive sit sunning themselves in a row on the wood benches in the park and watch the processions in and out. Funerals in the morning, weddings in the afternoon. Slow bell in the morning, fast bell at noon. In one door and out the other, the old men sit there in their hats and watch the coming and going. You have seen them, the ones who feed the pigeons, cutting stale bread with their thumbs and penknives, the ones with old pocket watches, the old ones with gnarled hands and wild eyebrows, the ones with the baggy pants, with both belt and suspenders, the grappa drinkers with teeth like corn, the Piemontesi, the Genovesi, the Siciliani, smelling of garlic and pepperoni, the ones who loved Mussolini, the old fascists, the ones who loved Garibaldi, the old anarchists reading Umanita Nova, the ones who loved Sacco and Vanzetti. They're almost all gone now. They're sitting and waiting their turn and sunning themselves in front of the church, over the doors of which is inscribed a phrase that would seem to be unfinished from Dante's Paradiso, about the glory of the one who moves everything. The old men are waiting for it to be finished, for their glorious sentence on earth to be finished. The slow bell tolls and tolls, the pigeons strut about, not even thinking of flying, the air too heavy with heavy tolling. The black hired hearses draw up, the black limousines with black window shades, shielding the widows with the long black veils, who will outlive them all. You have seen them, Madre de Terra, Madre di Mare. The widows climb out of the limousines, the family mourners step out in stiff suits. The widows walk so slowly up the steps of the cathedral, fishnet veils drawn down, leaning hard on dark cloth arms. Their faces do not fall apart. They are merely drawn apart. They are still the matriarchs outliving everyone in Little Italy's all over America. The old dead dagos hauled out in the morning sun that does not mourn for anyone. One by one, year by year, they are carried out. The bell never stops tolling. The old Italians with lapstrake faces are hauled out of the hearses by the paid pallbearer in mafioso morning coats and dark glasses. The old dead men are hauled out in their black coffins like small skiffs. They enter the true church for the first time in many years in these carved little black boats. The priests scurry about as if to cast off the lines. The other old men still alive on the benches watch it with all with their hats on. You have seen them sitting there, waiting for the bocce ball to stop rolling, waiting for the bell, for the slow bell, to be finished tolling, telling the unfinished Paradiso story as seen in an unfinished phrase on the face of a church, in a black boat without sails, making its final haul. (laughs) So he did have a way. that was yeah, there's a poignancy, you know. I guess it's kind of a this difference between nostalgia versus a sort of a loving portrait of a poignant moment in the history of his neighborhood. In nostalgia, there's often this kind of a inevitable element of clinging, of longing for the good old days, you know, for the better times gone by. But even though there's an element of that in his poetry, there seems to me to be at least as much a simple appreciation for the turning of the wheel. Clinging versus reminiscing, you know. In the 16th, 17th century, I think, in Japan, there is a poet named Basho, and he wrote a poem once. It's even in Kyoto, hearing the cuckoo's call, I long for Kyoto. So what he's longing for is the Kyoto of the mind, you know, the Kyoto he once knew. And so Ferlinghetti's, you know, book, his poem, you know, Coney Island of the Mind, it was the same thing. if I were to write a similar poem, you know, it would probably be something like, you know, even in Berkeley, hearing the campaniles chime, I long for Berkeley. of course, what I'm longing for is the Berkeley of the 1970s. the Berkeley when I first came alive and everything was fresh and new, yet to be discovered, right? Just a little taste, just a little taste. So I'm interested if any of the rest of us have kind of been similarly touched in this way by poetry that's helped us understand or experience the Dharma maybe in ways that that just hearing the prose can't do. So please, love for anyone who would like to share, you know, their own experiences or thoughts or reflections.
Gloria had her hand up, right?
Gloria, please.
Yes, I was just thinking about her today, I think, and sharing it with a friend. Jane Hirschfield is someone I've been very moved by. And I was particularly influenced by an interview she did in, what's the Buddhist publication that's stopped doing hard copies?
The Inquiring Mind.
Yes, The Inquiring Mind.
Yeah.
And the interviewer asked Hirschfield two questions, and she answered them in the same way. One of the questions is, why does she do her art? Why does she write her poetry? And the other question is, why does she practice? She's a Vipassana practitioner, and has been for a long time. And the answer was, as I said, the same for both. To see things as they really are, both inside and outside the mind. And that has struck with me. It was about 10 years ago, maybe now. I know we were still meeting at the Unitarian Church.
Yes.
That seems to be the essence of it for me.
Please say it again. It's like hearing poetry twice. Please say it again.
To see things as they really are, both inside and outside the mind.
Right.
When you read her poetry, she writes about simple things in the most beautiful way.
Yes.
When you see them, through her eyes.
Yeah, the women didn't get nearly the acknowledgement the men did either back then or even more recently when it comes to Dharma poetry. Yeah, the interview was done by my very dear friend, Wes Nisker. And he was a San Francisco radio personality in the 1960s. And for a while he lived in the North Beach area. And he did a kind of a countercultural alternative newscasts in the afternoons on KSAN, KSAN Jive 95. And his nickname was Scoop, Scoop Nisker. And Scoop would, he'd spend his days hanging out in the Cafe Trieste, which is this kind of legendary coffee shop in North Beach that poets and artists and writers, Herb Kane, the San Francisco Chronicle columnist, would go there a lot. I loved going to Cafe Trieste with Wes because of who he'd run into, you know, and some of the conversations that would happen. And he was really good at, you know, drawing forth people like her, you know, and just providing a place where they could make clear how the Dharma manifested, you know, in art, and how, how to find the Dharma in everything, right? Yeah, it's good, really sweet. He's the one who said, you know, if you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own. That's how he would sign off all of his newscasts, you know. He was reporting on riots and the anti-war demonstrations, and then he moved to the East Bay. That's how I got to know him best. He's in his 80s now. He still teaches out at Spirit Rock sometimes. He still reads his poetry. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. So, anybody else? Karen, please.
Just about an hour ago, I heard a poem read, a poem by Mary Oliver.
Yes.
And, you know, so often she just says so much. And to me, she touches on themes that are very, bring to life things in the Dharma.
Oh, absolutely.
So I might, if I might, I'll read this. It's just, it's fairly short. It's called "Freshen the Flowers," she said. So I put them in the sink, for the cool porcelain was tender, and took out the tattered and cut each stem on a slant, trimmed the black and raggy leaves, and set them all, roses, delphiniums, daisies, iris, lilies, and more, whose names I don't know, in bright new water. Gave them a bounce upward at the end to let them take their own choice of position, the wheels, the spurs, and the little sheds of the buds. It took to do this perhaps 15 minutes. 15 minutes of music with nothing playing.
Yeah, she may be our best nature poet around, right? And she lived in a little cabin on Cape Cod. It's a really very simple life, but she's one of those who it's like I read her stuff, I go outside and I see nature with slightly different eyes, you know.
It's so, to me, that's so foreign, her writing that I know is so foreign to kind of the resignation in the Italians dying. I feel a lot of resignation in that poem.
So yeah.
Sitting there in Washington Square, old grimy hats, so on. But she's, to me, she kind of always brings mindfulness.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Wes interviewed her too, reads a lot of her stuff on retreats. Yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. And it's really sweet. Anybody else?
Hello?
Yeah?
If no one else wants to speak, I would like to...
Please?
Okay. I learned a poem that struck my heart and really sunk me deep into the interdependence of things.
Okay.
And it is by Mary Oliver.
Oh, please.
Okay. Yes, I learned it at a time that was a very traumatic and stressful time of my life, and I used it to, like, nurture myself. And
good. Yeah?
Okay, here it is. And probably all of you have heard it. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knee for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to love that soft animal in yourself. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of rain are streaking across the landscapes, the mountains, the valleys, the prairies, and the deep trees. Meanwhile, the wild geese are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, high in the clear blue sky, exclaiming your place in the family of things.
Hmm.
Thank you for listening.
Well, and if you don't mind sharing just a thought or two about how was it that you happened to find that to be healing and supportive at a time.
The line that says, you only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves.
Yeah.
I think I misquoted it in the beginning because I haven't recited it in a while. You only have to let the soft animal in your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair. Yes, and the other place that really sunk me deep into nature, like you said, and I think of the M.S. Escher drawings that were popular in the 70s.
Yes.
Of the birds, you know, there are also, something else. Like, and, you know, but it kind of, like, took you to interdependence, and maybe that's why they were popular in the psychedelic era.
Mm-hmm.
But another part was where it says, you know, meanwhile the wild geese are heading home again. And if you ever have been, like, by a lake or outside somewhere where, you know, wild geese, you know, come and they're nearby, and they're flying overhead and they make this sound, and the sound just really gets to you. And her poem described how it felt. You know, you feel a part of that via the sound.
Yeah. 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 I'm so grateful for you all sharing some of her work tonight. For me, what she does is, you know, we've been trained for so long to consider ourselves to be apart from, external to nature or the natural world. And what I think I really appreciate about her work is this kind of reminder at a very fundamental level, you know, that all this vastness, that which we call nature, is within us, you know, we are not different. We are not separate. We are not other. You know, it's like, so when she, in her poem, for me at any rate, when she offers nature, it's all ultimately about an invitation to look within. You know, that whatever wonders we see there, whatever we find there, whatever we find awesome about the natural world is all within us. But that awe and that wonder that lies within us is not different from, not separate from, that which is around us. Very sweet. Thank you. Anybody else? Okay. Well, there's another of Ferlinghetti's that I'd like to leave us with tonight. I think the poem is actually called 99. And in it, there's a reference that he makes. The Dzogchen teachers and the Vajrayana, Buddha Dharma, one of the teaching objects that you'll find on their altars is a crystal. And what that represents in their cosmology, there is a primordial light or a primordial source from which all things flow. And the crystal symbolizes our consciousness, and the understanding is that the primordial light falls upon the crystal, and then our consciousness fragments the light and projects it onto the world around us, so that when we are looking at the world around us, what we are basically seeing is our own consciousness projected onto the world around us. What we see when we look around us is the contents of our own mind and how we understand the world and take it in. And their understanding, you know, whatever is in the mind's, however the mind is functioning, creates the world that we see. It's the same thing that Buddha said in the Dhammapada,